coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Hey Kids Comics. I am Andrew Farmer. With me, as always, is the Lord Jedi Cole Houston.
Greetings, and forsooth.
You have found us betwixt, between, and right in the bosom of this current story arc. The reason for the season on this summer solstice, the oil on the blade, the chafe from the armor. Get Medieval, I believe, is the name that Cole gave us.
Yes, we are Hey Kids Comics number, what, 233.
Officially, unlike the last time we called a show 233 and it wasn't real.
So we are definitely hip to what's going on. And in fact, during the entire show, I will be devouring about 6 whole chickens. One bite, throw the rest over my shoulder.
Right. And so you went to Scarborough. You went to Scarborough Fair before this, is what you're saying. You shop Scarborough Fair like a grocery store.
Exactly.
With us tonight,
you know, turkey legs is good 5 hours later. I'm just saying.
With us tonight is a very special guest, and I'm going to let Cole introduce him as is his wont, and explain why he's on the show tonight.
Well, tonight we have none other than a comic book aficionado, a dear friend for more of my life than anyone else, and probably the reason I have a shoulder to cry on whenever I remember Camelot 3000. Someone who understands not only me, but understands the tragedy that No, it's none other than Steve McCauley is joining us again on the show after a lengthy hiatus.
Greetings and salutations, my good men.
That's good. Can we just do an hour
of
that?
Well met.
I love the fact that Steve is here, because the first time I talked to Steve and Cole together was about Camelot 3000.
Wow, I had no idea that was the first time.
Well, Cole used to regale me with stories of Camelot 3000 and about how you guys were collected it, and then you had to wait the 11 months and 2 weeks that it took them from issue 11 to issue 12 to release it. So my earliest conversations with Cole about you were about Camelot 3000. So and every conversation since has come up, which I'm completely okay with. But finally, I broke down and said, I gotta know what this is. I've never read it, and you guys rave about it, regardless of whether it's the insane ravings of a madman or the applause of a critique. So I had to find out.
It's been forever since I've read it, so it may be very, very rose-colored glasses as well.
Shockingly, it's not. I read it. It's very good. But in my reading, that's when Cole and I came up with the idea that we need to do a story arc based on all these different time periods. And of course, if we're doing Medieval, Steve was a natural choice. Absolutely. Choice for that. So,
And just in general, we really wanted to have you back on the show for a while. And I want to point out that I'm not sure who suffered more.
But you or him?
During this Camelot 3000.
Agreed.
Us? In those days. Because he had to put up with weekly visits with his cigarette in his hand, his warm beer at the counter, thinking, how long till those kids get here? Hour.
Asking about the damn
hour and a half.
You gotta Stand By Me bike riding
sign on the door. Sorry, no Camelot 3000 this week.
Of course, this was also before the days of internet.
Yeah.
And I think maybe even previews. So yes, there was
correct.
There was no clue what was coming out each week.
The only thing you had was Marvel and DC both published kind of monthly rags that would tell you what was coming out, like a month later or something like that. But they weren't always 100% because they weren't, you know, you couldn't count on. There were a lot of published
before the days of Marvel Age and or when they
yeah, it was
putting
Marvel Age and Direct Currents were the
true
were the thing. But the problem was that you know, sometimes stuff would be caught up in production problems and stuff. So there were some minor inaccuracies, and you still see that today. The biggest problem was when Marvel in Marvel Age had a release date for JLA Avengers, and we would find out about a year later that even at that point the entire project was dead in the water.
Right.
And it was just like, why did you even do that? So.
Well, you know why. They jumped the gun for publicity. You know, they got excited because they were finally doing something. Somebody came to the editorial staff of Marvel Age and said, we got it. We got a date. Well, we're going to run it. And then, no.
Yeah, apparently nobody, they didn't talk to Jim Shooter, who killed the project.
Talks to Jim Shooter, Cole. You talk to the monkey. The monkey talks to Jim Shooter. Sorry, I'm better now.
And it actually just depended on how Jim Shooter felt that day as to whether or not it was going to be published or not. So
that's so true. It was if you ever saw Scarface.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you mean felt that day or could feel anything that day? Because that much coke in your system really will mess you up. Yeah, yeah, we call Jim Shooter out all the time on this show. We are relentless in our pursuit of bringing the truth about Jim Shooter to light. Sue me, Jim Shooter. I shouldn't say that. That's probably going to get me in trouble. No. Yeah, it's a bad idea. That's a bad idea. So where do you want to start this, guys? We generally, in the last two, we've kind of started with, you know, why do we always, and this is my, if I seem really excited and amped, this is my favorite time period in, you know, in all of history, first of all, because I'm a giant nerd, and this was like, you know, when you start reading things like you play Dungeons and Dragons and you read Tolkien, and it all kind of feeds back to this, this mythology of the medieval time period. I worked at the Renaissance Festival for a while. You know, there's this rose-colored mythology when it comes to this time period.
Oh, absolutely. And some people listening might go to medieval times dinner and joust or dinner and tournament.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to record the show at medieval times, but I figured that...
Oh, yeah, that would have been cool.
I figured that
might
be a
little
problem.
Loud.
Too much yelling and wenching.
Yeah, I mean...
There's so much wenching.
It's a two-winch minimum in there, and we got a show to do, so we can't be bogged down with that. Right. So, yeah, where do we want to start? Why? Let's start with why this is so... Why do we go to this well so often? Why do we go back to this?
I think what you, in my opinion, I have nothing to back this up, so.
Just neither do either of us.
I think we can start by looking at the Arthurian legend, which, of course, fed into Camelot 3000, and where so many of the different comic book representations of the time period sprout from. The Arthurian legend, you know, just seems to me to be superhero story, you know, jam-packed in
that's
in
exactly
medieval,
what I was thinking.
You're absolutely right, and we've talked about this one is a little different though, because when we talked about, you know, we've talked about there wasn't so much in the prehistoric period, but when we talked about Egyptian and
well, nothing anybody wrote down.
Well, that's the problem, right? You bunch of jerks. They could have at least left us something with their little tiny T-Rex arms just writing. when we talked about Greek and Roman, and when we talked about Egyptian time periods, you know, their superheroes were steeped in their mythology. And like Kelly was saying last week, mythology wasn't their religion as much as it was, you know, philosophy was. Mythology was their stories. Mythology was their HBO, their Game of Thrones, their Breaking Bad. And in this, you know, we start seeing these Arthurian legends and these epic poems the way that we see them as the superhero story, as the Superman, as the Iron Man, and that's really cool.
Well, also with the Round Table, everybody was Iron Man.
That's true. You had the Iron Man's table, the literal Iron Man's table.
Yes. But also going back to what Steve said about that, you know, this was their superheroes. Very much the Roundtable was their Justice League, because you had a very distinct knights of name.
Yes.
Some with very colorful histories and very colorful.
Including the Green Knight.
Yes, I was very thinking colorful. Of the Green Knight, who would often pledge that in Brightest Day and Blackest Night.
That's a different guy. Yeah. That's a different guy.
It's not Green Light. Green Knight.
Did they ever do that? Can anybody recall if they ever used that in comics? Because I know if we're going to talk about like Elseworlds, there are a thousand of, you know, every other Elseworlds was medieval Elseworlds. It just was. Like I said, it's an easy well to go to. Oh, they're going to fight the dragon Dark Sidious. Okay. Like, it's like, okay, all right, guys, let's go. All right. Roll it out. Sure. But did they ever use the Green Knight as Green Lantern? I can't remember.
Yeah, it was the big look again. I don't believe so. That would have been a given, I don't remember. It seems to me.
I mean, it seemed like every other Elseworlds was Batman, so I don't know that they ever did any. And in fact, the only Green Lantern one I ever, I think, purchased and bought, or remember even, was the one where Batman was Green Lantern. So.
Well, can't get away from Batman.
Steve,
now,
every
what's
other
thing is what's that in Kingdom Come.
Yes.
You stole my thunder.
You got Alan.
Of course he did. He's Steve.
In a
No, yeah, you
we have
did.
A much older hive, Steve.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That's true. But I do want to make a point, Steve, and that is that not only is every other Elseworlds a Batman book, every other Batman book is an Elseworld Batman book. So don't worry about it. That's what Batman is now. It's just a bunch of Elseworlds books where he does weird things, and Grant Morrison gets a hold of him and puts his hand up his butt and makes him talk like a puppet, and Alfred's the Joker, and it's just like, what are you, what? Okay, whatever, go with it, I don't care. No, you're right, and Cole, as he so eloquently put it in the last three of these, how much of this speaks back to a Victorian sensibility on our part to continue to go back to this well?
Oh, I think, yeah, it very much, even more so perhaps in this case, because as you get into this sort of Victorian hero worship and history worship, inevitably, one thing you're going to gravitate to a very British or European, and they own this sucker.
Right. This is theirs, baby. No, you are absolutely correct on that front. So
I guess the only other superhero they've got is Green Arrow. Oh, I'm sorry, Robin Hood.
Oh, that's right, Robin Hood. Green, what?
Same
Green
time period.
That's true. That's
It was Oliver Queensland.
Oliver Queensley. God, Cole, why? That hurts.
It was Sir Oliver of Queensberry.
Developed the Queensberry rules of archery.
It's very good.
So
take that, Hoyle.
In your nose, Hoyle. Sit on it. So what are some of our favorite... Do we have any favorite stories that are based in this time period? And I think when we talk about this time period, it's sort of like when we talked about Greek and Roman, but even more so, where the time period we're really talking about here is not historical medieval times, because that's sad and boring. Nobody wants to actually live in historic – nobody wants to relive the times of the historical medieval times. What we're really looking at is the sword and sorcery – Arthurian legend period, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yes, indeed.
Nobody wants to be a peasant
right.
in medieval times.
Right, there's not a lot of chamber pots being cleaned out in these comic books. That's... So, does anybody have any favorite stories based in this time period? I know I personally have one in particular that was my absolute favorite.
I've got one that doesn't actually take place in the time period, but it's probably my favorite setting sort of a medieval story. It's actually from the Avengers Volume 3 when they rebooted after Heroes Reborn. It was Busiek and George Perez.
Right.
And I believe they had every person who had ever been an Avenger involved in a story where Morgan Le Fay transformed all of the Avengers and I think maybe the entire world, I can't quite remember, but the entire world into basically medieval England. And
Morgan Le Fay, what's a Morgan Le Fay?
She's Arthur's sister. No,
I think it was like
there's not much you can do with that.
So just to double back on what you just said, the idea was that she got a hold of some Norn stones from Asgard and proceeded to use those.
She got them from Nordstrom.
God, you can get a really nice a cold brewed coffee maker and some Norn stones from a. Right. You can register your wedding at Nordstrom's. And she's basically started taking over all of the world, essentially.
Right. The first issue, I guess, has all of the Avengers fighting these Asgardian Norse. Legend,
right?
That she has called forth using the Norn Stone, I believe.
Okay,
right. 56, then, 56 Avengers, 56 of them.
Good Lord.
Yes,
and all of them drawn by even D-Man.
Yes, yes.
Well, no one draws D-Man the way Perez does.
Well, it actually worked.
the most unsung Avenger, D-Man.
What I do remember about that first issue is non sequitur, but what I do remember about that first issue was he included every Avenger that had ever been an Avenger, even if they were dead, by putting like pictures on the wall.
Much like how the JLA Avengers managed to squoze
exactly,
in.
Exactly. It was a lot of fun Easter eggs just reading. And I think that was true of most of Perez's tenure on the title. I think he loved drawing the Avengers. But anyway, in the story, Andy, if you can remember it better, I think the second issue just starts off with everybody in their medieval guises.
Right. No, for sure. That's exactly
the only one that's not is that nobody knows where she is the Scarlet Witch.
Yes.
And I think it turns out that Morgan is using the chaos magic of her power and the probability of changing of her powers to power a lot of this, keep this going.
Does she not capture Scarlet Witch? They grab her and they take her somewhere. Yeah, they kidnapped her and they started using her as a conduit between those Nornstrom's coal, those Nornstones.
It's because you're Nornstruck.
And Morgan Le Fay's crazy elf witch magic to make everybody into a modern day, like basically what we were saying earlier, into medieval times, into a Renaissance festival.
Well, the thing about this,
you had characters. It was fun because they had characters like Iron Man became Iron Knight, Captain America became Yeoman America. You had others. What was funny was Black Knight stayed Black Knight.
Just stayed Black Knight. just Black Knight. He was really at home in this story. He had finally found his niche. He was right there.
He probably wanted to stay.
Right. He pulled a Cypher from the X-Men Asgard Wars.
Exactly.
No, I'm good. You guys head back. I'm all right here. No, I got it. I'm good. Like, no, this isn't real. Yeah, no, it's real. It's real to me. Shut up. I'm
it's
staying.
Real enough.
I got a flying horse, an ebony blade. I wear this helmet all the time. I don't think you understand. Like, have you been summer in New York wearing full plate armor riding a flying horse? Not fun. Smells. Let's just let me be here. How about that?
I make D-Man feel better about himself in the summer. But he's also like, it's like breast implants. If I can touch it, it's real.
Oh dear.
And I think they
it gets comics after dark.
and they had to lay siege to the whatever castle Morgan Le Fay was running in her Morgan Le Fay world, her Renaissance festival that she built for herself. So it's like all the Avengers, because this is one of those Avengers books where it's one of the who will be the next Avengers, because they were rebuilding the team after Heroes were born.
Oh,
so it's like
Steve and I have a particular history with those.
Yeah, I love those. Those are my favorites. When you get everybody in Avengers Mansion and the Thing's there for some reason, just cause.
Yeah.
He was a West Coast Avenger for like 5 seconds.
Was he?
Yeah.
Was he? Just, was he really? Just because you have the card.
As they say, pick two, answer inside.
That's right. Listen. The Thing was the egg roll that came with combo number 3. All right, let's just. But that's. Yeah, it was great. And what's funny about you bringing this up is I remember, because this is my. This was my period in comics where I was really getting into comic books. It was right after I got real excited for Heroes Reborn. I didn't know any better. I was pretty let down.
Well, who did? I mean, yeah.
This was the period where I was going to comic book conventions, the very beginning of me really going to comic book conventions, and Rob Liefeld was selling off his table the Fighting American books because they wouldn't let him do Captain America anymore because he screwed up so bad. And so he made his own.
Well, you know, his anatomy for Captain America.
It was perfect.
Wow.
It was perfect.
Captain America had never been so chesty.
No. I don't know how he moved at all.
Yeah.
Like, not just his neck. I don't know how he moved.
No, it was like when you're trying to balance a baseball bat on your palm.
Well, and he also had teeny tiny feet.
Well, that's what I was going to say. His ankles, man. That super soldier serum is amazing. His ankles.
Oh, yeah, otherwise they'd have just snapped clean.
That's right. But, you know, it was during that time period, and I love this. I love, like I said at the top of the show, I love the medieval sword and sorcery time period. So when you have, you know, all the luminaries, everybody, Thor was, of course, pretty well at home here. You had guys like a show favorite Dr. Druid making appearances. You even if it's a panel or two, you had, like you said, Yeoman America riding his horse with somehow still having an American motif to his outfit, even at this juncture. Like, it all just worked for me. So, Steve, thank you for bringing that up. That's my favorite book. But later we find out that I think it's in the same story arc that we find out that Dr. Doom's been traveling back in time to bang Morgan Le Fay. Like, that's part of the story. Is that a thing?
That at all.
Well, they met online.
Yeah, like that's part of the last issue. Is that Doom continues to go back in time to have a weird relationship with Morgan Le Fay, which is great. But yeah, it ends with
maybe that's how Kang the Conqueror was born.
It ends so the way that the world was remade, the way that Morgan Le Fay made the world was with the Twilight Sword, which is, I believe, Surtur's sword. Is that correct? Maybe I'm crazy.
That's correct.
Okay.
That was the one that, I guess, Walt Simon's great arc that Surtur was banging on for like 20 issues.
I mean, yeah, it was Doom.
Yeah.
Banging on that the way Dr. Doom banged on Morgan Le Fay, traveling back in time. Yep, that's what happened.
Hey, kids, comics after dark, indeed.
Keeps coming. It just keeps coming at you. So, yeah, it ends with that. But so what was it about this story arc that really grabbed you, Steve, and made you really want to read it? Because it was like 3 issues.
Yeah, it's very, very short. I just checked something real quick and found that it was called the Morgana Conquest.
Of course it was.
Or the Morgan Conquest was the name of the... it was the name of this arc, and it basically... I absolutely love that we had all of the original Avengers back in the real Marvel Universe.
Right.
But the fact that it was Perez doing the art, and the fact that they incorporated anybody who had ever been an Avenger into the storyline, I just thought it was a lot of fun, and it was a great way to kick off I think an amazing run by Kurt Busiek.
That was a really good Avengers run. It really was. Like, that was a really cool time in the Avengers, because they were trying to get it right after Heroes Reborn, so they brought in the pros to get it right after Heroes Reborn, and it was a really good run.
In fact, they had Mark Waid on Captain America at mm-hmm. the time. They had somebody really big. I think they had Claremont, actually. They brought him in to do Fantastic Four.
I think so. They really made it work.
Yes.
So, Cole, what about you? Do you have a favorite character, or do you have a favorite...
Well, the funny thing is that one of my favorite just little sidebar things ever was when Steve's the one who got me into Crisis on Infinite Earths. I was a staunch Marvel man back when Crisis came out, and Steve insisted, you should check this out. It's really good. And it didn't hurt. I mean, not to impugn Crisis. For its time, Crisis was absolutely brilliant and still holds water to this day.
It was incredibly world-changing, because they never did this. Every issue, especially DC, usually had a reset button at the or arc or whatever, had a reset button so that a new reader could just, okay, I know what's going on. This is Superman, and he's trying to hide his secret identity. I'm sorry, go ahead, Cole.
Oh, no, it's all right. But, you know, it didn't hurt, though, at that time that Marvel's answer was Secret Wars.
Oh, man.
So, you know, that helped even further bolster what was already turning out to be a really cool book or series there. But one of the neat things about that was, in trying to do very much like you're talking about, just Easter egging everybody into the process, trying to get as many characters in as possible in that wonderful way that Perez can do almost better than anybody else. They were jumping all over time period and time period and time period, and finally they land in there was a couple of scenes where the crisis I guess they wanted to establish the crisis was not only happening on all these Earths, it was also happening throughout time simultaneously.
That's cool.
And they had a thing where they, you know, here they are at Camelot. Anyway, silly drawing. But they had this scene where, you know, Merlin is trying to figure out what's going on. You know, what strange magic be this?
I think that was when the Monitor had thrown up the giant tuning fork.
Oh, that's right.
The universe.
Okay, yes.
And the heroes were to keep the anti-monitors, dark demons, from attacking and destroying the tuning forks.
Yes, and there was a shot there where all of a sudden here comes the demon Etrigan, who I had a vague familiarity with. And it was like, you know, I really shouldn't be that strange that Etrigan would be hanging around that far back in time, because he probably predates everything. Technically, Etrigan predates all of the time periods we've talked about.
Right.
We may have even met Vandal Savage, for all we
know. DC's The Demon by Jack Kirby has his origins in the Arthurian time period.
Major
Merlin
Blood.
Merlin is actually the one that ties him to Jason Blood.
Yes, that's right. So that was kind of a neat thing, because I never realized that connection because of my vague familiarity. And I thought, that's kind of cool. And he kind of dresses the part, too. He's always ready. He's got his puffy shirt on.
He's got his little loinclothy leather downstairs doublet going.
So it was just
downstairs doublet. Yeah.
That's right.
That was the name of my next album is Downstairs Doublet.
That's good.
But that was kind of fun, because it sort of tied some of the DC universe into the Arthurian cycle. And as we mentioned earlier, I think the Arthurian cycle really is the defining. It's the pivot on which all of your medieval adventures hinge,
mm-hmm.
almost without exception.
That's true, especially in the Marvel and, well, in the DC universe, I think. I can think of several different, you know, we already talked about the demon. And another one is the Shining Knight.
Oh, yes.
Who so, was to be, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, since you brought up Shining Knight, I was going to go with mine, which is, to combine your two thoughts, there was a book that was released during the New 52, which did not get a long run, but I absolutely adored. And if anybody is a fan of Sword and Sorcery comics and DC comics, they have to pick it up. And it's called Demon Knights. And it is the story of the Middle Ages, this time period, starring Etrigan, Lucifer, Madame Xanadu, Vandal Savage, Shining Knight, and then introducing three other characters. It reads like if Sam Peckinpah was running a Dungeons & Dragons campaign that had a soundtrack by Lindsey Buckingham, that's what this would be. It's amazing. It's so cool.
I have to say, I overlooked Demon Knights. I did not see that.
It's a 2011 New 52 release that only got, I think it only got like maybe they pulled it, I think either the first or second time. It was 2 years. It ran for 2 years. But you have, you have this awesome kind of character interaction and this kind of organic biology built between, you have Shining Knight, who is obviously, as you're going to tell us here in a second, which I won't go too far into, but an Arthurian knight, and then you have the demon, but you also have Vandal Savage, who's been working on his machinations since the prehistoric times. You know, you have Xanadu, who's been around forever, who's basically their Merlin in their group, and they're all kind of working against each other in opposing angles, but somehow managing to like just you know, Jason Statham themselves across Europe and cause trouble and help people in the process. It's really kind of a cool book. So if you get a chance, read it. But go on about Shining Knight, because Shining Knight's an important figure in this particular story.
I think Shining Knight was actually a Golden Age character.
Yes.
That had been added to the Seven Soldiers of Victory as an Arthurian knight, not tied to the demon, because the demon, of course, didn't come out until the 70s.
Right.
I think that's, you know, sort of been retconned in that they actually may have known each other back in the day.
Right.
But
for sure.
My recollection of the Shining Knight is that he was, I believe, the last knight of the Round Table, and Merlin did something that put him to sleep for until the 1940s, along with
because he becomes a
right.
The first time I'd ever run into him was during when I was reading the All-Star Squadron, which was a neat book that sort of was trying to follow World War II and what the heroes were doing during World War II, as to why they couldn't fight, you know, on the battlefronts of Japan and Germany. And trying to secure the home front from supervillains and Nazis and the Japanese. So that's where I first ran into him. He was actually, they had a little core group in the very beginning of that series, and he was one of those cores.
In fact, the
Shining Knight was amongst many knights of Arthurian origin, if I remember correctly, that were part of the DC lore, because there was a... I remember first encountering this character both in The Crisis and in Who's Who, which was coming out about the same time, and I didn't quite make the connection. Silent Night.
Oh, that's right.
And like one day it finally hit me, like, oh, seriously, Silent Night.
And of course his brother, Holy Night.
Of course. or as I was riding back and forth to Steve before the show, we were talking about, we'll get into as we get ready to wrap up, kind of the influence of the medieval concepts on the contemporary characters. And Steve mentioned, of course, well, naturally the Dark Knight.
You sure?
Would fall squarely into that. Like, yeah, of course I thought of that. And of course I remember that, you know, that Muggerville had a knight of old character, Nighty Knight.
Yeah, Nighty Knight. Yeah, yeah. But don't forget my all-time favorite knight, which would be Moon Knight. has his own.
Oh.
Now, granted, his is greatly Egyptian, but then later, you know, he does take on some influence. And of course, Black Knight, which we've discussed, is one of my favorite Marvel characters of all time. The idea that the Ebony Blade is from Arthurian time, and that it has traveled with his bloodline, his lineage, from the original Black Knight during that time period up to Dane Whitman now, and he used science to test the blade to make sure that it could cut through anything, but it also infuses him with the bloodlust. If you use it to harm an innocent, then you are going to be, you'll have to continue to kill, and that's what happened with the Black Knight back in, you know, all this great lore has been steeped into that character that I don't think very many people know about, and I think that it's a highly underutilized character. I think the Black Knight could be used much more.
Oh, yeah, well, especially after he traded the Ebon Blade for his lightsaber.
Damn it.
Well, he saw the Star Wars.
George Lucas is going to sue somebody.
Well, listen, man, you can't take the Ebon Blade and hide it in an Avengers-branded bomber jacket. You have to have something smaller.
Avengers branded.
Yeah, the scabbard was clashing.
Yeah,
it's true.
Bomber jacket.
If Tony Stark's making you a lightsaber, you're going to use that. I mean, but yeah, Shining Knight.
That's kind of wise, because Tony Stark turns into the technological version of your knitting grandmother.
Right? That's hilarious. That's hilarious.
You sit around, you know, knitting electronics together and hands it over to you, and you're obliged.
You have to use it. Like, yeah. Captain America's holographic, solid light hologram shield that he made for him. He's like, oh, that's great.
Right around that same time period, too.
Yeah, that's great. Will this make me a chicken fried steak like I used to get in 1944? No? Well, then kiss my ass, Tony. Kiss my ass. I love
the most wanty Avenger.
I love the fact that the callback joke for Captain America is about chicken fried steak from 200 issues ago. continues to live on.
That was some good chicken fried steak.
While we're talking about Shining Knight, my favorite iteration of Shining Knight, because I have to, is from Grant Morrison's Seven Soldiers of Victory. So when he kind of reinvented and recreated the Seven Soldiers and put it out, it was to be read as simultaneous at all points in time at once. So you had all these characters acting at once. You had Miracle Man, you had Shining Knight, you had Frankenstein, Zatanna, Clarion, the Witch Boy, and all of them are working in tandem with each other to try to solve the same problem throughout time. And Shining Knight's part was, you know, they had a central focal point to the whole thing that was basically like the Dark Tower, if I'm going to make a literary analogy, which kind of bridged the gap.
That was that game that Orson Welles was endorsing, right?
Yes, it was one of those VHS games that you would put in, and then he would drink too much wine and pass out. Yeah, but
that's it. I'm out of here.
But it the Shining Knights portion of it was that. Most of the Knights of the Round Table were captured or killed by the antagonist. Shining Knight, being the youngest fledgling Knight of the Round, managed to escape, steal Excalibur, and then kind of jump through time in this Dark Tower way and end up in modern-day New York on a flying horse with Excalibur, and then have to acclimate. So that's sort of the way that they did it with when he redid it, and it was really, really cool. I think Shining Knight is a very, very cool character. I really do. I just don't think it gets, again, enough credit. It doesn't get enough credit.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of those characters I think suffers a bit from being, you know, the motif gives the wrong impression. And like so many characters, under a really accomplished writer, they become something far better than they were ever intended to be.
Right. Sure. So, what about using? Are there any characters or anything that calls back to this time period as far as concepts, conceptually? You know, how does that play? Because, you know, we've talked about how the JLA sort of – we talked about during our religion episode, in our mythology episode, how the JLA, when again, Grant Morrison relaunched them, and before that we all knew it was true, were representative of the Greek gods and the Roman gods. So is there anything conceptually that we can think of that would be callbacks to this time period in comics?
Well, what's interesting is both the Avengers and the JLA, whenever we see them meeting, are always meeting around a round table.
Very true. Very true.
That's true. And they also, I think, become that same sort of idea of the Knights of the Round Table being the protectors of the realm. The superhero ultimately is the combination of the pantheons of the classics and the Arthurian knights.
And the conceptually, the round table was created round so that there would be no one would feel like they didn't have say in any conversation. Everybody was on equal footing, which, you know,
yeah, there was no head of table.
Which aside from Batman never wanting to sit at the table and hiding in the corner and up in the rafters, you pretty much had that dynamic in any of those arrangements.
Oh, absolutely.
So,
and of course, you know, when you had, as we often talk about, the precursors to Batman Incorporated, one of the oldest men of bats, as it were, are knight and squire, because apparently if you are the heroes of London, you got to, like, play up the whole knights in armor.
Speaking of...
thing even more than...
You know, I was about to say, that's really interesting. I hadn't even thought of it, but what brought that in to me was Captain Britain.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In
yeah.
which they actually brought Merlin back to give him his powers.
Oh, I'd forgotten that. Yes, he had the magic.
The original.
Yeah. Because he had that his Britain stick.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he had a choice between the amulet and the... I guess the scepter.
So, yeah, I guess
it the was. Lion's head scepter. Is that what it was? I can't remember exactly what it was. It was something like that.
I don't remember either. But I thought he picked the amulet, but and then he still had the scepter. So I think it may have been a sword or the amulet.
He chose wisely.
Or it could have been like one of them has the power, the other. You get to pick one. Which one has the power inside it? And then you get both, but only one of them has any powers.
Right, you're just carrying around a stick at this point. That's all you're doing.
He put the powerless stick. Yeah, well, the scepter had no power because that's the one thing that the bad guys are going to want to get from you.
I don't know. I think they want to get that fancy little mask.
But they're going to assume that the scepter has the power in it.
That's true. That's true.
They will be wrong.
So here's one that maybe happens a little later, but I think we can still shoehorn it into this. Speaking of homage and, I guess, you know, pulling a reference, look no further than Kurt Wagner, X-Men's Nightcrawler, with his swashbuckling ways. That was his main fighting style, was Errol Flynn.
Wow.
You know, rapier and mangoosh.
That's a good point. As George Takei would say of the Amok Time episode of Star Trek, it was Sulu's chance to swash his buckle.
But that's, you know, that he pulled that because, you know, and they say every actor needs an actor's secret. And his was, you know, I'm holed up in a Catholic church being called a demon, but I'm going to watch every Errol Flynn movie I can. I've watched Captain Blood 800 times. I'm ready to do this. I thought that was a really cool affectation for that character. You know, for a character that could have been pretty milquetoast besides the fact that he was blue and had a tail, adding that kind of oeuvre to that character really brought it out of the woodwork and made it super cool. So that's one that definitely deserves reference.
That's interesting. Yeah, if you open it up, it does. That does look. And of course, it's Nightcrawler.
Yeah. Oh.
So yeah, you can feel
another
free.
Knight.
Feel free at this point to go into all of your knights because we're getting close. So
yeah, we need to wrap up here pretty soon. I one of them that's kind of interesting to me because I had no real prior familiarity, but our good friend Frank owner of the Manticore, Caladon. old callback there.
Yeah.
He once, had gone to see some movie with him, and we come out of the theater, and there are these banners promoting the upcoming Mystery Men movie, and he just about freaked, and we're like, what is this Mystery Men? He goes, oh, it's so cool. They're from Flaming Carrot. And over the years, I got kind of curious about it, and the characters in the movie are similar, but a lot of the origins and a lot of their backstory and stuff were more grounded, and you know, some jokes were excised, like the spleen was supposed to have got his powers from swimming in Love Canal, but they felt that that joke was too dated for modern audiences. And one of the things that they changed was in the movie, William H. Macy as the shoveler shovels very well.
Right.
Probably better than any man shovels. But apparently in the comics, the concept behind the shoveler was that he found an ancient Arthurian artifact, the singing shovel of Arthur.
Right.
Apparently there were a lot of singing artifacts back then, and he had actually found the magical singing shovel of King Arthur.
You know what's funny that you bring that up, because that brought to mind another character that we should probably talk about, which is Kevin Matchstick from the comic book Mage.
Yes.
And he was the reincarnation of King Arthur. And he had an Excalibur,
right.
But his Excalibur was a glowing baseball bat. And he had that Flash Shazam lightning bolt on his chest. And he would, I believe, wasn't the town that he lived in? Because he was a vagrant. He was a homeless guy. No, he wasn't. But he met Merlin. And then, was it the town he was in, Fisher King? I'm trying to remember.
Wow. I'm not.
Wow.
Yeah, I remember.
You're well beyond me, Andrew, on this.
I really liked this book back in the day.
I remember coming out, but I never read it myself. But it was ubiquitous back in the day.
Yeah. It was one of those independent books.
Yeah, it was an indie that really took off, much like ElfQuest or a handful of other indies back then that just were always out there. You know, I think we'll probably need to go ahead and wrap things up here, but we cannot let the elephant in the room remain unspoken beyond just passing mention, and that is, of course, Camelot 3000, because it was so only amazing. A model.
So amazing. I'm going to let you guys talk about it, because it was for me, a weird kind of reverse coming of age, where I wish I would have read it back in the day, but I wasn't able to.
And I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on air, but as I recall, Steve, you may remember this as well, that the concept was that, according to lore, King Arthur would make his return in Britain's hour of greatest need.
Yeah, in fact, that's actually been used to explain Churchill.
Exactly.
Places.
Because I remember when we were reading this, you were like, well, I guess World War II wasn't enough. You know, without factoring in the Churchill angle, you know, apparently World War II proved the concept that Arthur wasn't quite as needed. And then apparently they get about 1,000 years of Arthur sitting on his laurels before something comes along.
Well, I guess this would have been wiping out the human race. So maybe that's what was needed to trigger.
Yeah, including the very British portion thereof. So, yeah, if it's just downright universal genocide, that does mean that 100% of all of Britain will be wiped clean from the earth. So I guess, yeah, he gets a pass.
But I do love, we talked about the fact that King Arthur, he's running from the aliens in the recently excavated ruins of some monolithic stone thing that they found before the aliens.
That was buried down.
Thank you. And I love that you had said something, and it was hilarious, to the effect of course they would just leave King Arthur's stone tomb laying right in the middle of the hallway in the, you know, and nobody somehow found it except for him as he was just running through this thing away from aliens, just, oh, boom, runs into it, and then takes the time to open it. Like, oh, well, I should probably, there's aliens chasing me, I should probably take the time to crack this bad boy open and see what's in there. Like, it was great. It was so weird. I loved it. I loved it. It was awesome.
Well, he was probably drawn to it, like, you know, finding out you had a twin brother who lived overseas all these years, except that your twin brother is you and you, and you're dead. That somehow made a bizarre sort of sense to me as I said it.
It made complete sense. I loved it. Oh, man.
One thing I really love, if you look at Thor, the Marvel movie Thor.
Yeah.
When he goes to recover,
meow meow.
Yeah.
Meow meow.
Michelob.
Mr. Wiggy, just a Mjolnir. But anyway, he goes to retrieve Mjolnir, and there's this whole excavation around which nobody can, you know, you can't even dig underneath the hammer.
Right.
To get it free. And I'm sure a lot of people said, oh, that's so awesome. What a great concept. And Steve, I don't know if you had this impression. I was like, I liked it better the first time when it was called Camelot 3000. They had some guy in one of those, motorized air chariot Knights of Wendigore thing with a grabber claw trying to yank it.
But also, didn't they try to, they had like a giant jackhammer to jackhammer underneath it as well.
Laser jackhammers and stuff. Yeah. And the same sort of concept was there, is you couldn't even, like, you know, okay, there's only X amount that's going to be underground. We'll just excavate and cut it. You couldn't even cut into the earth below it.
Yeah, didn't they have to build their new UN around Excalibur because they couldn't move it? And they're like, screw it, move, just build around it. That's fine.
I believe it actually just showed up there.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Merlin created it to show up there. So
I like my version better. All right,
we'll just try to.
I've been here for 3,000 years. What are we gonna do?
Well, we can't put this anywhere else. Can we, like, maybe, you know, appropriate some more land to the left and just make kind of a courtyard?
No, Cole, it's zoned. It's already zoned. We can't. We got to do it here. This is where it is now.
Zoned.
It's like that old Looney Tunes where Bugs didn't sell, so his land has that one area of the building that is just his hole.
Yeah, he just had like this little alcove that the architects had to build around and work out exactly how to make this arch around it. So,
well, they
that
really
worked out. Well.
They really needed that place for their water cooler, and they were praying that Arthur would show up at some point and get that out of there. They're like, ah, come on.
That explains everything. It was actually the UN who basically got the alien invasion started.
Right. They're like, this is here. We have to move it. We need a challenge great enough to raise Arthur because we only have enough room for the cold water, not the hot and the cold water, and this is Britain, and we need tea. So aliens. Somebody call Mordred. Morgan Le Fay.
You can lay the blame at the feet of the United Nations Europe.
That's right.
It's not the JLE, it's the UNE.
It's UNE. It's the UN. All right, let's wrap this thing up. What's next week? Next week we're doing
First, I think we'll thank you, Steve, by the way, for hanging
absolutely
out through technical glitches and making this happen, because this has just been an absolute treat.
It's so much fun.
It's been a pleasure having you. being here.
I mean,
what was the line from Monty Python? Not at all. I enjoyed being in it.
That's right. How are you?
How are you, Ed?
It's how are you in? No, thank you, Steve. This was the natural choice. You always bring so much to the show, and in this particular one, not only did you bring everything to the table, like, I would not have been able to explain that. I didn't remember characters' names in that Avengers book. You really brought the thunder tonight, and we appreciate that, man.
Well, thanks, guys.
You pulled this like a knight in shining armor. from a long time
damn
ago.
Damn it, Cole! I told you on the phone. We do not sing Peter Cetera. We do not touch Peter.
You saved the day. Took us to a castle far away.
Ha ha. This is a long going inside joke between Cole and I now, where Cole likes to sing Peter Cetera and it makes me angry because it reminds me of my childhood in a Ford Caravan driving back from the Lebanon Swim Club and I couldn't get ice cream at the A1 drive through. All right, I'm good now. I'm back. Okay.
Well, we will be back next week with the conclusion of Period Pieces.
That's right.
Which is the Wild Wild Best. We're going to talk about the Old West. And I think we're going to have, like, there's just a ton of characters, Marvel, DC, and otherwise. So we're not going to be hurting as much. Because unlike some of these other time periods where there's not a lot of material that took place during the time period, but there's a lot of influence in the contemporary, this is a time period where it's the reverse. There's a ton of characters because Western comics were once king.
Right. And right?
The police and detective type stuff and horror. Oh, yes, and the infamous man who couldn't be licked, who wouldn't be licked from a...
That's right.
From a historical comic that was auctioned off at a convention years ago.
I can't wait.
The auctioneers could not stop laughing trying to tell that one of the features in this book was the man who wouldn't be licked. And, of course, you know, he's beating the hell out of all these adversaries.
Different connotation in the 50s.
This wasn't a Penthouse Comics release. This was a
okay.
Yeah, this was him not being beaten back by all of his preponderance of enemies on the cover.
Hey, listen. But sometimes men can't be licked. Sometimes the Joker gives everybody boners. It was a different time back then.
Yes. Yes, back when the Joker was known for his many boners.
That's right. Just hitting left and right, just handing them out like boner candy.
Wow.
What a visual.
Boner candy is my next album.
I am front loading your discography tonight, Cole. Don't worry.
Thank you very much. Yes, we're going to be talking about the Untamed West, the Western characters, because there aren't that many characters who adopted the cowboy look. That was pretty much disco bands. So
sorry, that one hit me right. Thanks, Cole.
So I'm assuming you're going to have, like, Jonah Hex.
Oh, yes.
Kid Colt.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and Two-Gun Kid.
Matt Lash.
Oh, yeah.
The Vigilante.
The original Ghost Rider.
Oh, the original. Now, there's one that was influenced by the Vigilante was a guy who was actually influenced by the time period, right?
Right.
Yes, indeed. There was the original Vigilante was he was a cowboy on a steel horse he rode. And when you do it in that tense, you can't go on with the lyrics.
You can't. You can't Goldblum Bon Jovi, Cole. You just can't do it.
So, again, thank you, Steve. We're coming to you, of course, from the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com. You can check out our tweets at the Jedi Cole U. Write to us at JediCole@Yahoo.com. Yes, JediCole@Yahoo.com. I don't know where my stuff is anymore. Check out me and Eddie Medina on the first and third Sundays of every month from noon to 1 Central on DallasOnAir.com, the new home of the Rancor Pit Live. And join us on Saturday if you're in the Burleson, Texas area at Geek Out. We'll be doing our live recording at noon. Eddie and I'll be there a little before noon, and Eddie will be there for however long Eddie remains there. And as the fourth stop on the Rancor Pit Roadshow Summer Invasion Tour.
That is awesome. I'm so excited for you guys. That's amazing. As always, if you find us on iTunes, rate and review us. That's how people find us. That's how people say they like us. That's how eventually we're going to be able to afford to do more live stuff and get out there more and put more content out there. We love you guys. We wouldn't be doing this without you. So I guess all that being said, I think we can say huzzah good night tonight. I think that's a safe bet, right?
Oh, forsooth, yes.
All right. So everybody say goodnight, and we will get out of here. Thank you again, Steve, for your contributions. You are always amazing.
Thank you, guys.
Good night,
thank
everybody.
You, good nighteth.
Good nighteth. Good dark nighteth.
Good darkest nighteth.